Darlene, everything's okay with Darlene? They ruled out, it was muscular, I think is what they said. Okay, so we're glad, we hate that you had to go to the ER, but we're glad it's something that was not serious, something really serious. Joel's making announcements. We also want to remember Gene Frazier goes tomorrow and has a test to determine whether he will have more chemotherapy or not. So they're going to determine whether it's been effective. And so we ought to be praying that it comes back good tomorrow, and he will not have to have any more chemotherapy. If they determine that it's been effective, and he is sure hoping for that. It's been a long road. He's been very sick. Obviously, Angie's been here some, but Gene hadn't been here at all since really his last trip to Atlanta. And we certainly want to be praying for that, for the people in Florida and everything else. Lots of people need prayers right now. And I think there was Chris and Brittany Bell. Brittany had messaged the group that we're part of earlier, and she's sick. She's got the flu. So lots of folks have the flu right now. Tom? Jerry Wright. We want to remember Jerry. That's right. Jerry's probably sicker than he wants to let on that he's been sick. I know Norma says he tries to get up and do, and it sets him back a little bit. But who? Little George has the flu. Okay, I thought it was Brittany. So her son George has the flu. So the flu is rampant right now. Everybody's got a touch of something. It's good to see Jim back with us. He got sick Sunday. He's back. You can't keep a good man down. It is. He's like a Timex watch. He just he takes a licking and keeps on ticking. And I think all of us are praying when we're 92 or 3, we want to be that healthy. That's amazing. It's such an encouragement for him to be here. That's great. And good to have Glenn here. That's awesome. Okay, so we started a study a couple of weeks ago as a part of our ethics study on gambling. And we said, let's lay some foundational principles first before we talk about applications, about scenarios. And we really don't want to do what if this, what if that. We don't want to do hypothetical situations. What we want to do is establish the principles. Here's what the Bible says. Here are the principles. And then we're smart enough to be able to take and apply these principles as they fit different scenarios and what is and what is not right and such along those lines. So we're going to do the same thing tonight. We've got a few, maybe a few pointed applications to make toward the end. But we want to discover one more principle in the Bible before we start making applications, before we try to apply this to any sort of a scenario, and that is the principle of stewardship. We talked about it a little the last time we were together, but we want to really sort of focus and key in on that because this really becomes one of the determining factors in how we use money. It's the principle of stewardship. So at the very beginning, if we're going to talk about stewardship, we've got to go back to the principle of ownership. So, whatever's in my wallet, whatever's in my bank account, whatever clothes I have on, whatever car I drove here, whatever you did of the same, ultimately, who owns all of that? All right, God owns all of that. That's got to be our starting place for any use of money, whether it's an illegitimate or a legitimate use of money. So let's discover a few passages together. Let's go back to Job. Job 41. Job 41. Job 41. Now, obviously, we're near the end of the book, so we're coming to the end of all of the trials and God's challenge to Job. We're coming to the end of it all. And it's really beginning chapter, well, some of the earlier chapters, but really chapter 40 is very pointed toward Job. The so-called friends of Job have really sort of worked his mind over where he sort of puffs up a little bit, and God settles him down really quickly about who's ultimately in charge. And one of those is verse 11 of Job 41. Who has preceded me? What would be the answer to that? Nobody has. Nobody's ever preceded God. He's existed before anything that was created existed. Who has preceded me that I should pay him? God doesn't owe anybody anything. No one can place God in debt to him. And then he says, everything under heaven is mine. Everything belongs to me. I made it all. I mean, we may fashion it and take one form and move it into another form, but it is all God's. It all belongs to him. That doesn't mean that he's the author of everything that people do, because sometimes people do really bad things and he's not the author of those bad things. But whatever it is upon the earth, he owns it. It's his. He created it all. And so whatever substance that we use, even if it's something we barter with or we purchase or whatever, he owns all of that. It's his. How about Psalm 24? Psalm 24. Psalm 24. Verse 1, the earth is the Lord's and all its fullness. Now, he could have said it and stopped it at the first statement. The earth is Lord's, it's, and everything in it would be his. But for the sake of emphasis, he expands that. All the fullness of it. Everything on the inside of the earth, everything that's on the earth belongs to God. And then in verse 1, he says, the world and those who dwell therein. So every single thing belongs to God. Same book, Psalm 50. Let's go up just a few chapters more. Psalm 50. Psalm 50. Verse 10. For every beast of the forest is mine. I own them all. I mean, you may be shepherds and you may herd them, but they belong to me, God says. Verse 10. And the cattle on a thousand hills. I know all the birds of the mountains and the wild beasts of the field are mine. It all belongs to me. Now, when it says that God is the owner to a thousand hills, does that mean if you counted 1,001 hills, didn't belong to God? What's the point here? Everything belongs to God. So the use of the number would be for the sake of emphasis. It's just, you know, it's emphatic. 1,000 hills would be a lot. It's for our word picture. Can't even imagine seeing 1,000 hills in a row, but it's for the sake of sort of comprehending the scope of what God owns. He owns it all. It's all his. Everything belongs to the Lord. So if it all belongs to God, how does that affect our view of money and possessions? How should it impact us? Same way? Okay, used to the good of God. Any other thoughts? Any other thoughts? I mean, there's no wrong answer here. This is what does it do to us to you know, we're pulling out our wallet and getting ready to pay for something, and all of a sudden, whoa, that is God's money inside my wallet. What's that do to us? You think it makes us, if we remember that, do you think it makes us a bit more responsible? Not wasteful, you know, to use it to the glory of God. I think all that becomes part of this word, steward. It becomes all of that. Miss Carol? Yes, that's right. There's a responsibility, and we're accountable for the way that we use it. And I think God can give it, but he certainly can take it away. I think that's a great, great point. So that comes to this word steward. If someone says, okay, let's talk about stewardship. What does stewardship mean? What is a steward? Okay, overseer. Any other words you can think of? Okay, care and possessions. Glenn, it looked like you were about to say something. Yeah, it deals with the handling of something, and I think Joel's exactly right, and Terry and everybody, you know, it's the way we manage something, and since we're talking about the ownership of possessions, the possessions belong to who? Which makes who the manager? Us, right? So we're managing someone else's possessions. For example, if you walk into, or I walk into, someone else's house, you may not be of this mind, but are you a bit more careful with the possessions in another person's house than you are with your own? Yeah, that's the way we are. Unless you're a moving company, and it doesn't matter if it's somebody else's possessions or not, you just throw them in. That's how they work. But generally speaking, if you're in someone else's home, you treat that home with respect, because those things, the furniture, whatever is in that home, doesn't belong to you. So you try to treat it carefully, because you've just been granted temporary access to that. And in the same way, in exactly the same way, we are the managers of God's possessions. We are just simply managing what belongs to Him. We are overseeing the possessions that are His. So we're just simply using the possessions that are not ours. So that's what it means to be a steward. 1 Corinthians 4, here's a passage on stewardship. Now, this passage probably has a more generic application, probably much broader than just the use of money, but it would certainly involve the use of money. In verse 1, it said, "So let a man so consider us as servants of Christ and stewards of the mystery of God. Moreover, it is required in stewards that one be found faithful." And that kind of goes to what Carol was talking about responsibility, and it can be given to you, but it can also be taken away. So that principle certainly involved in that. So stewardship goes to that. Now, this goes to what Bobby was saying. So if God is the owner and I'm the manager, how then do we use the possessions that are ultimately God's and we're managers of? How do we do that? What do we do with those things? Okay, we have to do it very carefully. Now, for example, remember the story of Joseph? Joseph went down to Egypt and he ended up in Potiphar's house. And there was a statement made about Potiphar and Joseph. It said, Joseph was so responsible with Potiphar's possessions that Potiphar often didn't know what was going on in the house. He trusted Joseph to manage the affairs. So there's a liberty that's involved in stewardship. The steward is able to use those possessions in a way that's fitting of the master's purpose, but the master gives, he delegates authority for the steward to do that. And so in the same way it's with us, we're at liberty to use that as best fits our life in harmony with the Father's will, but we're still responsible for those things. So we're supposed to use them with a view of God. There's a statement in Ecclesiastes 12:13, after he says, you know, the whole of man is to fear God and keep his commandments, he'll bring every work into judgment. That idea is whatever we do, even with money, the way we use money is supposed to be fitting of the fear of God and the keeping of his commandments. We do it all with a view of God. We all are supposed to do that. And we are responsible for the way that we use money. There is there's the parable, Luke 12. We just made reference to it here in the notes. There was a parable where the man says, I've got these barns. I'm going to tear down my barns. I'm going to build greater barns. And God comes on the scene and says, you're a fool. This night your soul is going to be required of you. What was the point of that parable? What was the real fault of that man? Yeah, he wasn't in the picture. I think I heard Millis before talk about the number of personal pronouns. You did that in a men's Devo one time, number of personal pronouns. My barns. And he never mentioned God, never did that. That is an illegitimate use of money. When a person says, this is my money, this is what I'm going to do with it, I can do this with it, without thinking this is God's and how is it going to best suit God's purpose. So we all have to be of a mind to do that, even though he grants us the authority to use it as we see fit, as long as it's fitting of his purposes. Now, that's going to clear us to make some applications. We had a lot of principles last week about the week before last, about the way we gain money, about working, you earn it, and things of that sort. If goods are given, there's something given in exchange for goods, those types of things. There are some inherent risks of life, but there's a difference between an inherent risk in something and something that is an artificially created risk that's just mere chance, something like that. So let's sort of sandwich this down into a definition. And there are people that have far better definitions than I do of what gambling is or consists of. So here's a couple of definitions. Years ago, there was a man by the name of Herbert Spencer, wrote a series of comments on the Bible, but he had a good definition. He says, quote, gambling is a kind of action by which pleasure is obtained at the cost of pain to another. Now, what did he mean by that? For thinking about gambling, how would it cause pain to another? Okay, because that other person, or the other people, they lose their possession in the gambling process. So everybody's putting up of the possessions in a chance to gain the possessions of another. Of course, they don't want to lose their possession, and neither do you, but you're gaining at their loss for that. It affords no equivalent to the general good. In other words, if you get what that person has put in, if you take their money, what have you given in exchange for it? Nothing. There's been nothing. No work. There's nothing given in exchange to make that an honorable practice. The happiness of the winner implies the misery of the loser. So that is based on, I think, a good definition, some of the principles that we've already seen in our lesson. Here's another one. Thomas Eves. He was a preacher. died well before his time. He was a missionary and caught some sort of weird virus, I think, in India or somewhere like that, and ended up killing him. But he was just a great, great preacher. And he wrote in a book one time, he said, a simple definition of gambling would be desiring the possession or possessions of another, the prize. The gambler creates a risk, that of losing his own possession, in an attempt through chance to gain the possession or possessions of another with nothing given in exchange. So much like the same, he's putting up possessions of his own in order to gain the possessions of another and then leave them with nothing. So if we look at those definitions, and there are others, there are plenty more definitions, but those are really good ones. There's some pretty consistent elements here. So here's some consistent elements. One is the idea of chance. It is not an inherent risk, it's an artificially created risk. There's the putting up of God's possessions in a wager, because remember, they belong to God. They're not our possessions. It would be taking what God owns and putting it into a wager, an artificial or created risk, attempting to gain another's possessions with nothing given in return. Now, given those definitions, is there anything wrong with that? And if so, what would be wrong with that? What are some principles, or what are some faults we would find with that kind of activity? Do you see anything wrong with it? Okay. There would be a violation of the principle of stewardship. Now, we're not talking. Remember last time we said, let's clear the air, because this is where sometimes people say, well, the stock market is kind of risky, or owning a farm is kind of risky, or getting in your car and driving down the street is kind of risky. There's a difference in an inherent risk, which is part of life, and a pure created risk in a game of chance. There's a big difference between the two. So I think the principle of stewardship, Bobby, comes into play. So there's one of those. What about the mentality? Do you see a problem with the mentality in this definition? What's the goal?
You're trying to gain something
by doing nothing in return. Do we have Bible words to describe what that is?
Laziness.
Is there another one? Greed, covetousness. It is the desire. Like, for example, if I'm doing something in the hope of gaining millions, what's my ultimate desire?
Money.
Is it to be rich? Is that my desire? Does the Bible say, do not desire to be rich? It does say that. Let's look at 1 Timothy 6. 1 Timothy 6. There's a big danger that comes with that. Verse 9 of 1 Timothy 6. But those who desire to be rich fall into temptation and a snare, and into many foolish and harmful lusts, which drown men in destruction and perdition. For the love of money is a root of all kinds of evil, from which some have strayed from the faith in their greediness and pierced themselves through with many sorrows. Now, we could take a principle we talked about the last time. The Bible talks about one of the ways that we gain is through earning it. So if a person becomes rich and they've earned that wealth, are they likely to abuse that wealth? Not as likely to abuse it. And there's nothing wrong with gaining by the sweat of the brow. That's talked about in principle. By the sweat of the face, a person earns, and some people earn in life a lot more than others do because of whatever. They just do, and for whatever reason they do that. But there's a difference between that and these artificially created risks, selfishness, the covetousness, the greed, materialism, and things of that sort. And generally speaking, in a gambling type of activity, it's the selfishness and the greed and materialism that's driving that type of activity.
Also, what happens to the person that loses,
Sure, yeah. And I think it goes to this. In fact, we had listed in the notes right there, under number 2, it's letter D, Matthew 7, verse 12. What's the principle of Matthew 7, 12, the golden rule? Do unto others, treat others, as you yourself would like to be treated. And so there's a principle of doing what is best for people. Even if people don't want to do that or don't do it in return, it's proactively doing what is best for other people. So we have to be really careful that we don't involve ourselves in activities that are driven by greed and covetousness. We have to check our heart and make sure that it's not taking something from somebody with nothing given in exchange. We have to be really careful that we avoid that kind of activity with the principles that we've already talked about on the other side of that as well. Let's talk about this. This is a part of the gambling thing that that sometimes people never talk about. There's a principle Jesus gives. Now, he's talking about false teachers. Back in Matthew 7, about verse 15 beginning, he starts talking about false teachers. You know, they're in wolves in sheep clothing. They're ravenous and they're hungry. And he says, at the end of that text, he says, a tree is known by its fruit. That's a good principle. Sometimes you can tell a lot about the activity by the fruit that comes from that activity. Are there things, are there fruits that come from gambling that are worth taking note of that might tell us something about the practice of gambling itself? Can you think of some of the fruit that comes from gambling? Okay, and there's a big one. There are a lot of folks who are addicted to gambling. It's very, very addictive behavior. What's in the mind always of the gambler? What's he thinking? I'm going to win this time. And when he loses, what's he thinking? I'll get it this time. And when he loses that time, he's thinking, I'm going to really get it this time. It's a very highly addictive activity, and there are lots of folks who are involved in that. I knew a member of the church. He was a member of a congregation, and I didn't know him directly. I just know of the man, especially the preacher was a friend of mine in the congregation where we worked. He was addicted to gambling, and he didn't tell his wife. He hid it from his wife. And he lost their car, he lost their house, he lost pretty much everything, lost all their savings, all their checking, all of it was gone. And the very last thing to be taken was the house. Well, that was after the fact. He was out somewhere and a repo guy took the car. And he had to come up with an excuse to try to tell his wife something. And so he bashed his head into a telephone pole and caused a deep gash and went to the police and told them the car was stolen, all that. And, well, that scratch got ripped off, and all of a sudden when they did the police report, it was determined that the repo man grabbed the car, and he had to own up to the fact that he was a gambling addict. They lost everything because of his gambling. They lost everything. So it's a very, very damaging thing. Any other things that you sometimes know that are connected to it? It's interesting that there's always almost one, with gambling, there's almost sort of a common type of people that are connected to it. Especially in Vegas and in Jersey. Is crime not always and sometimes associated with gambling? Crime is sometimes associated with that. Sometimes you get the mob involved in it, and it's interesting that crime is often associated with this activity. So sometimes the fruit tells us something. It gives false hope to people. It promotes addiction. It breeds crime. It shatters homes, families. Tom, what were you going to say? Right. There was an article in the Tennessean, which is based out of Nashville, but it was a good article a couple of years ago about the lottery, about the state lottery. And what they were reporting on, and this reporter had, it was not a religious bias, it was just a reporter non-religiously writing about that very thing, about the fact that the lottery ends up being the greatest tax levied against the poor of every state, because they're the ones who are banking their entire livelihood usually on lottery. I want to read just a statement out of this. It was a really, really good article. So out of the Nashville, Tennessee, and this is from the 1990s, but she writes this article, Sylvia Porter does, and here's what she says, quote, "Those who wager money on state lotteries often are those who can least afford it. A national survey not long ago found that people at the poverty level spend an average of 2.3% of their income buying lottery tickets. The lottery is, to some, their chief investment vehicle. Viewed as a tax to raise state revenues, it is the most regressive of all taxes, because the poor actually pay more than the rich, both as percentage of their income and in actual dollars. Nor have lotteries proved to be the big money makers states had hoped that they would become. Now, she quotes from a New York lottery vendor, a person that sold lottery tickets in New York, and she's quoting, and this person says, "It's really very sad. I have people come in here and spend $25 or $50 buying lottery tickets and playing the numbers. Those are people who aren't doing well. They're poor, they can't afford it, they're on public assistance. You'll get an occasional guy in a business suit, but he always buys one ticket. The ones who buy dozens are the ones who are really desperate." Then she picks back up and says, "During the recent Pennsylvania lottery frenzy, there were excited interviews with people who spent $1,000 to $5,000 buying chances. I'd better win because this is my mortgage money," one lottery ticket buyer said. Fiscal irresponsibility is not, she says, heroic. And she was talking about, and that was when Tennessee was fidgeting with the state lottery, and she was trying to write about the reason why we didn't want to do that. But she's right. A lot of people do, who can least afford that, are caught in that cycle because they're thinking, this is my way out. This is the chance for me to do that. I didn't bring statistics tonight, but have you ever looked at the odds of winning in gambling for something like the state lottery? So example, you see the number driving down the road and it says, in total, the Powerball plus the lotto is $564 million, $500 million, and you're like, wow. You know what your odds of winning that are? It's not 1 in 1,000. It's literally, you have a greater chance of being bitten 7 times by sharks in the ocean or being struck 7 times in a row by lightning than winning the lottery. It's complete chance. It's like 1 in 700 million or something like that. It's just statistically, it's just impossible. Now, it happens every now and then because of the number of people that play it, but it is an amazing, amazing thing. So, amazing thing. Yes, sir? Yeah. Yeah, and it never does as much as what people say that it is. So let's look at a couple of arguments where somebody might say, "Hey, here's this," and let's think about the logic of this. So this is number four. Sometimes arguments that come up about gambling. Somebody says, "Okay, gambling is no different than winning a sporting contest." How would you answer that? Is it the same thing? Why is it not the same thing? Okay, so there's the use of skill involved in that. Let's say that, just off the top of my head, whatever it is, a golfer, let's say he gets in a golf tournament and there's $1.2 million prize. In order to gain that prize, what he has to do? He's got to beat everybody in the field. He actually has to use skill, and he's exerting effort. And so there's a big difference between a person who is earning, even though it may be a sporting competition, versus a person who's putting up God's possessions in a wager of pure chance, statistically, where there's literally no possibility of winning that. So there's a big difference between the two of those, or anything where a person would use skill or something like that. And so there's a big difference between the two. Someone will say gambling is the same thing as winning a prize. There's a big difference between the two. You can win a prize without gambling. So we take the gambling element out, and the two are not the same. And then this one goes to what John was saying. Someone says lotteries are good because the money helps fund education. Now, there's something really wrong inherently with just the argument itself. What's the fault of that kind of reasoning? Okay, it's the old pragmatic line of reasoning that says the end does what? Justifies me. So let me just take lottery out. Let's put something else. Pornography is good because it helps fund state education. Would that be okay? No. Or murder is good because it helps fund state education. If we were funding state education with something that was clearly everybody understood, it would show us that the argument itself doesn't work. So we have to be really careful about the argument itself. So here's... I know that, going out, last time people were like, what about that situation? What about this situation? Here's the deal. We make wise use of our money. We try to use our money to the glory of God as God sees fit. We try to make sure that we're not squandering and wasting our money, or that we're not just in pure chance throwing it to the wind in hopes of getting greater return by artificial risks, not inherent risk, but by artificial risk, and trying to get something from someone with nothing given in return. We can stay away from that, and then whatever else may come up, we can use those principles and navigate to a decision that would be sound. Ultimately, if there's question, there's a statement in Romans 14, I think it's down in verse 23. It says, if a person does not act by faith, in other words, if he's not fully persuaded of the rightness of that activity, what is it to that person? Sin. If there's a question about the activity, as a Christian, what should we do? Avoid it. Don't do it. Don't have a question where it causes a conscience to be offended or someone else to be offended. But with the principles we established, we should be able to, hopefully we can come to a reasonable conclusion about the activity itself. Now, coming up, we want to shift gears a little bit and get into drugs. Do you think in the world, but especially in America, do you think we have a drug problem? Huge. If people aren't even on like hard narcotics, do you think people, even in congregations, have drug problems, addictions? Let's talk about that. Let's talk about where we go and what the Bible says about that next time we come together. Thank you for your great input tonight. Appreciate it.